From WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. We start this week with our monthly tour of science headlines, compliments of our friends at the journal Nature. Joining me on the line from London is senior physics reporter Lizzie Gibney. Lizzie, good to talk with you again.
Hi, Heather. Thanks for having me.
So Huawei, the Chinese tech company, has been in the news a lot lately, facing federal criminal charges of intellectual property theft. And now we're hearing that some academic institutions, notably UC Berkeley, rethinking relationships with Huawei. What kinds of relationships have they had?
Well, they've had various kinds of research relationships. So Huawei might be part of a collaboration, so they're giving some funding to the institution, or they have a general collaboration between academics at the company and at the university. Huawei have been investing loads more in recent years. So I think in 2017, they said that they invested about $13 billion around the world in R&D. And
Wow.
They're really ramping up the amount. Yeah, it's a lot. And they're giving a lot of that to universities. So we looked at the number of academic papers that were published with money from Huawei, and it's absolutely boomed. It went up from under about 100 in 2015 to more than 600 last year. So there really has been a rise in terms of the amount of funding that they're putting into academic research.
Well, and as I noted, UC Berkeley is saying that they're going to not take any more funding from Huawei. A couple of other institutions have said, yeah, we're rethinking, looking at our relationships and rethinking it. I mean, how big a shift could this be?
It could be a pretty big shift. As I said, the numbers that we're talking about is today pretty huge. They're not scrapping any existing collaboration. So if there's a research project that's ongoing, that's going to stay. But what they're not going to do is enter into any new research partnerships. At the moment, we know of UC Berkeley, Oxford in the UK, and the University of Texas at Austin is reviewing their relationship. But there are many institutions across the states who could follow suit. We're talking about a suspension at the moment. This all depends on what happens with those criminal charges. And of course, we should say that the company Huawei denies any wrongdoing in this case.
Shifting tracks a little bit, federal officials are considering changes to Title IX regulations that govern how colleges and universities handle gender discrimination and sexual harassment. Scientists have been really vocal in the public comment period that just closed. What did they have to say?
Absolutely. Well, Title IX is the primary legal weapon for fighting sexual harassment in US academia. And of course, academia is a sector that has a real problem when it comes to harassment. I think studies have shown that it's second only to the military in that aspect. So Title IX has become really important. As you mentioned, there have been a lot of public comments, 103,000 in 60 days. That's pretty unprecedented. And generally, not across the board, but generally, there has been a lot of concern expressed, some dismay at the changes to Title IX, because people are worried that the redefinitions included in it might effectively water down the legislation, make it harder for people to bring cases of sexual harassment, and to generally make it a more hostile environment for the victims.
Do you have a sense among these comments, is it primarily individual scientists or is it, heads of professional organizations, institutions, kind of larger organizational objection to this policy shift?
It's both, actually. There were a lot of comments from individuals, from students, from people who were victims themselves. So a lot of the comments were very heartfelt, actually, and quite, upsetting to read. But it was also universities themselves at a senior level. And to some extent, the changes in the regulations would ease the burden on them. And that is one of the reasons why the administration says that they want to bring about the changes. They say it's redressing the balance more in favour of the person who's accused and bringing the burden away from the universities. But actually, the universities themselves, in many cases, are saying, we don't want this change. It might make it harder for us to bring those sexual harassment cases that we actually want to and to sort out this problem.
Well, that public comment period has closed, so I guess we've probably got a few months to wait and hear what the response from the government will be and what that policy might actually look like. Lizzie Gibney, you're a physics reporter. Let's jump to something a little bit more in your wheelhouse, specifically a really interesting piece in Nature recently on how machine learning, artificial intelligence, could actually help prevent bioterrorism. connect the dots there for us.
That's right. So at the moment, it's quite routine for biologists to pay companies to make little snippets of DNA. That's become really cheap and easy nowadays. They say it's like pennies per base. And a problem with that is that people worry that bioterrorists might effectively synthesize some pathogen. Now, screening does already exist to make sure that companies are not making these dangerous toxins or viruses. But the problem is that in theory, it's very possible to change just a few bases within that sequence. So the sequence no longer matches the original, and maybe it's not therefore picked up by the screening process. But crucially, it still remains dangerous. So what this project is trying to do is use machine learning, the artificial intelligence technique that searches through many, many examples to try and find commonalities, to find patterns that maybe humans themselves wouldn't spot. So what they're hoping to be able to do with machine learning is by studying lots and lots of these sequences to figure out what it is that is the dangerous part of the sequence. So that means that in the future, rather than effectively matching your sequence with, you know, a big file that you have of existing pathogens, you're saying, is this sequence, does it contain something that would be dangerous? And that's really, really powerful. It means you can then look at perhaps newly synthesized toxins and find what might be dangerous within that.
Lizzie, this month is widely recognized as the 150th anniversary of the Periodic Table of Elements, and Nature actually ran an editorial calling for celebrations of the periodic table's birthday, in essence, which is kind of interesting because the periodic table itself is not a discovery per se. It's an organizational system for putting chemicals into some sort of organization, into some sort of order. What's so important and influential about the periodic table?
Well, perhaps I'm biased, but I think it's just absolutely smart and beautiful the way in which it's done and so useful. So, you know, the idea of a periodic table is pretty simple. You know, you line up all of the elements according to their atomic number, which we now know is the number of protons in their nucleus. And this pattern emerges, which is to do with the fact that as you go along, you are adding electrons and they fill up shells and then you start a new shell. And how many electrons in its shell that an element has in its shell relates to its chemical properties. So essentially you build up this picture that shows you the commonalities between the elements, and they then sit in columns. You know, you might remember from high school days that fluorine and bromine and chlorine will all behave alike because they all sit in that same column, which we call a group in the periodic table. So it's an incredibly useful device. And I think that was shown by the fact that, so when it was Dmitry Mendeleev who invented this way of organising it, and he actually put together these columns that relate to the properties, he left gaps because he realised that there must be missing elements. And then along the way, over the course of history, they were of course filled in. So that shows you the real power of looking at patterns and devising the structure in this way.
Lizzie Gibney is a senior physics reporter at Nature. Thanks so much, Lizzie.
Thank you.